And so may it be. Daniel chapter 8. Now the last vision that Daniel shared was in the first year of Belshazzar, the reign of Belshazzar. So 2 years later, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, Daniel received this vision. Now, the third year was the final year of Belshazzar's reign. So this vision took place in the year that the Medes and the Persians actually defeated the Babylonians. But Belshazzar was still king when this vision appeared unto him. And he saw in the vision, came to pass that when he saw that he was in Shushan, in the palace which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, I was by the river Ulai. So, at the time of this vision, Shushan was just a little kind of a nothing place. It later became headquarters for the Medo-Persian Empire. The palace was in Shushan. The story of Esther takes place in the palace in Shushan. So he was transported spiritually in this vision. He was there in the palace in Shushan. And so it was a time warp also, because at the time there was no real palace in Shushan, and so he was taken ahead in time and by the Spirit to this place in Persia, actually, the province of Elam in Persia, and by the river of Ulai. And I lifted up my eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before the river of Ulai a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. The two horns representing the two empires or the two kingdoms that had combined, the Medes and the Persians. The Medes were the first to arise. And then the second one, the Persians came up, but it became greater than the first. When Cyrus conquered Babylon, it was at that time that Darius was made then the king over the empire. Darius only reigned for 3 years, and Cyrus, the king who conquered Babylon, became then the king of Persia. So it's interesting how that the Lord, you know, is giving such detail here. We have the advantage of history. We can go look at the history books, and we can see how accurately things were being predicted here in the prophecies given to Daniel. In fact, they are given in such accuracy that as we look at history, we see the absolute fulfillment of it has caused the Bible critics really to do tailspins. I mean, that is why they give the late datings, the critics give the late datings to Daniel, because the theory is that God can't speak about things future. And the fact that there are such details of what is going to be, the critics say, well, it was written by another author at a later date and the name Daniel given to it, but it was written after the fact. Because, you know, we know that it's impossible for someone to write with such detail before the facts. And that kind of scholarship we can do without, for sure. Because it's a scholarship that's predicated upon total agnosticism or atheism, really. I mean, it's not honoring to God, and it is lacking, really, in genuine scholarship. It's just criticism. So the higher, the second one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. So the second one, the Persians began to dominate under Cyrus, though it began with the Medes. The first king was Darius the Mede, and then soon replaced by Cyrus the Persian. So I saw the ram, that is your Medo-Persian empire, pushing westward, northward, and southward. Now notice it doesn't say eastward, because you see, this was the easternmost area at that time. It was the area that more or less encompasses the area of Iraq today, the ancient Persia. And so they pushed westward, they pushed northward, they pushed southward. They conquered actually on down into Egypt. They conquered the Babylonian Empire and as far north as the Caspian Sea. So the accuracy of the scripture not mentioning anything towards the east as far as conquering, because they were the easternmost and were coming west. And so there was none that could deliver out of their hand. He did according to his will, and he became great. It became one of the wealthiest empires in history. The Persian Empire was known for the vast amount of wealth. And as I was considering, behold, there was a he-goat that came from the west on the face of the whole earth. It touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes, a very powerful, notable horn. And I saw him come close unto the ram. And he was, he came to the ram that had the two horns, verse 6, which I had seen standing before the river. And he ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close to the ram, and he was moved with choler against him. And he smote the ram and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and stamped on him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And therefore the he-goat waxed very great and was strong, and the great horn was broken, and there came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great towards the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and cast down some of the host and the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. And he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Now, this goat that comes so fast it hardly touches the ground comes with fury against the ram. We know from this interpretation to be Grecia. Verse 21, the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. So, again, looking at history, we see that Alexander the Great, the first king, this notable horn, came against the Persian Empire. And in 12 years, Alexander the Great in essence, conquered the world. And in those days, that was extremely swift, considering that Nebuchadnezzar took 12 years just to conquer the city of Tyre. You can realize how swift was the conquering under Alexander the Great. As he came from the west and he began to conquer over the Persian Empire, one city after another, one country after another, until he came actually to Persia itself and conquered Persia and actually sacked then the wealth of the Persian Empire, distributing it among his soldiers and gained the wealth there. Then this notable horn was cut off at the age of 32. Having conquered the world, Alexander the Great turned to a very licentious kind of a life, a life of drunken debauchery. And while he was in Babylon, he planned to make Babylon the capital of his empire. And while he was there in Babylon, he had been to a party where he had become very drunk, walked home in a terrible rainstorm, so drunk he didn't even bother to take off his wet clothes, just laid down on the bed, and in the wet clothes he got pneumonia. And he died of pneumonia at the age of 32. The horn was cut off. And so the first king of Grecia. But when he was cut off, the he-goat waxed very great, but when he was strong, he was broken. So they're in the prime, really, of life, 32 years old, broken. And four notable horns came up after him, and that was the four Roman generals, Seleucus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Lysimachus, his four generals who took over the Grecian Empire. Seleucus, the area of Syria. Cassander, the area of Macedonia. Ptolemy, Egypt and Cyprus. And Lysimachus, the area of Asia Minor. And so the Grecian Empire was actually divided into the four areas, as the four horns indicate, and the generals that took over at the death of Alexander the Great. But then the attention is drawn unto one of the kings of the Seleucus dynasty, who would arise and waxed great, even to the host of heaven. And historically, we know that this was Antiochus Epiphanes. And he began to war against Egypt. The land of Israel became really the battleground, as the Seleucids of Syria and the Ptolemies of Egypt began fighting against each other, and each of them, it seems, taking out their wrath on Israel as they passed through. And he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away. The place of his sanctuary was cut down, and a host was given to him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. And then I heard one saint speaking to another, the watchers, those heavenly beings that are watching over the affairs of man. And another saint said unto him, that certain saint which spake, how long shall the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, 2,300 days, and then the sanctuary will be cleansed. Now, again, we look at history, And Josephus is great in this period of history, and the book of the Maccabees, it's one of the apocryphal books of the Bible. You'll find the story of the desecration of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes. He came to Jerusalem. He introduced all kinds of excessive licentiousness to the young men of Jerusalem. He replaced the high priest and sold, auctioned off, really, the position of the high priest to the highest bidder. He sacrificed a pig on the altar and spread the broth all over the temple. And then he placed in the Holy of Holies a image of Jupiter. And he caused the daily sacrifices to cease and thoroughly desecrated the temple of God. So the question is asked between these watchers. And you remember earlier in the story of Daniel when Nebuchadnezzar was sort of bragging, these watchers were there, and they were they pronounced his doom, really, because of his boasting of himself, not recognizing that it was God who put him in power. So there is a scripture in the New Testament that says, "Wherefore, seeing we are encompassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses," we don't know all that is going on in the spirit world around us. Daniel is speaking now of this vision that he had. A vision is a trip, really, into the spirit realm. When a person has a vision, in reality, what you have is spiritual insight. God allows you to see into the realm of the spirit. Now, in the spirit realm, of course, you have neither time nor space. So Daniel was taken ahead to the palace in Shushan in time and also space. And he heard these spirit beings as they were conversing. And thus, when a person has a vision, you are moved into the spirit domain and you're out of the material realm of the flesh into the spirit realm, where you see the angels, you hear the angels, and that's basically what a vision is. It's insight into that spirit realm, which is a very real realm, of which we know very little. I'm certain that when we get to heaven and we know the whole story, we will be amazed at how intricately involved the spirit realm is within the material realm. So, how long? And the answer was 2,300 days. Now, in the year 168 BC was the year that Antiochus profaned the temple, offered the sow, put the broth all over the temple, and erected the statue of Jupiter and caused the sacrifices to cease. 2,300 days later was December 25th, the year 165 BC. And that is the year, or that is the date, that Judas Maccabeus cleansed the temple and started again the sacrifices. And your Jewish holiday of Hanukkah is related to this. It is the Feast of Dedication. We read about that yesterday in John chapter 10. It was on the Feast of Dedication that Jesus was on Solomon's porch in Jerusalem, talking again to the people who had surrounded him and demanded that he tell them plainly if he were the Messiah. So that Feast of Dedication takes place December 25th, and it, the first, of course, was in the year 168 B.C., and it was, and they still hold the feast today. They call it Hanukkah, and the lighting of the Hanukkah candles to represent how that when they came to the reinstituting of the temple worship, and they set the temple back in order, Judas Maccabeus and his cohorts, as they set the thing back into order, they found that they had only enough oil to have a one-day supply of oil in the candelabra there in the temple, in the holy place of the temple. And so they lit the candelabra with the one-day supply of oil. It took 7 days to compound this special oil for the burning in the candles. And so, miraculously, that one-day supply of oil lasted the whole 7 days. And thus you have the Hanukkah candles with the eight candlesticks. This is the menorah, the seven, which is similar to in appearance, similar to the candlestick in the temple. But the menorah that they have today are eight that they use for the holiday, because they had the one-day supply, and in the 7 days of preparation, and then by the next day, they had the oil, and thus the light did not go out. And to the Jews, it was a very symbolic thing that God caused the light to remain during this time. So the 2300 days was a literal 2300 days. Now, there was a fellow by the name of William Miller who, through some fanciful juggling, much like Wisenet, came to the conclusion that these 2300 days were actually years. And so he sought to determine the exact date the temple was desecrated by Antiochus, and he figured the 2300 years, brought them out to October 20th or so in the year 1844. And so the Millerites, the followers of this guy Miller, back in the Midwest, they had the city of Zion, and they sold their farms, and they all got together in white robes and were singing choruses and waiting on the Lord to come. And they were sure he was going to come on that date. And that date came, and the Lord, of course, didn't come. And so they waited an extra week before disbanding. And it actually had disastrous consequences. Many of those farmers who had sold everything and all became infidels, and turned away from God after being disappointed in this prophecy. But I don't know why people keep setting dates, because the Bible, the Lord himself said, no man knows the day or the hour the Son of Man is coming. And yet people are constantly trying to set dates. And I understand there's somebody that's setting now another date for 1992, and it's always, it seems, in October or September, and so that they're gearing up for 1992. And their books always begin, though, by the first chapter is always on why God didn't mean what he said. And they have to explain away the fact that Jesus said no man knows the day or the hour. And so the first chapter deals with explaining that away so that it gives them then the license to give you the day and the hour. Now, whenever a book begins by saying that God didn't say what he meant and he didn't mean what he said, that's all I need to read. I don't have to go on to any further chapters because you know that you're going to get into just vain imaginations of men. We don't know the day or the hour that the Lord is coming for his church, and the Lord has deliberately left that out of our sphere of knowledge. And it's going to be in a moment, it's going to be in a twinkling of an eye, it's going to be when no one is expecting it, in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man is coming. And so I usually just put it on my calendar that that's one day. I'm disappointed he won't come that day because some of them are expecting him to come that day. So I get disappointed because I think he can come today, and I hope he does. We don't know the day or the hour. Of the times and seasons, yes, you are not ignorant. The day should not overtake you as a thief, because we know that we are in the last times, but just the day or the hour, we don't know. So, Miller passed off the scene with a lot of disgruntled people, but then Ellen White came to the rescue, and she said that it wasn't the earthly sanctuary that the Lord cleansed at that time, but he came into the heavenly sanctuary and cleansed the heavenly sanctuary on that date. And Miller was right all the while as far as the date. He was just wrong as to the place. And expecting the Lord to come to the earthly sanctuary was where he made his mistake. But the Lord came into this heavenly sanctuary and cleansed it on that date. And so she founded the Seventh-day Adventist church. And founded on that foundation, you can expect that they will have other errors in their ways. So, it came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, and I sought for the meaning. Then behold, there stood before me the appearance of a man. I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, help this guy understand the vision. And so this is our first introduction to Gabriel by name within the book of Daniel. So he is commanded to help him understand. Now we'll find Gabriel again in the next chapter, giving him further understanding. So, he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid. I fell on my face, but he said, understand, O Son of Man, for the time of the end shall be the vision. All right, look at that now. First of all, the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, as he was speaking with me, I was in a deep sleep on my face toward the ground. But he touched me, and he set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make you to know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed, the end shall be. So the ram which you saw, now the angel is going to let him know the end things, but he's going to go back and help him understand this vision. The ram that you saw, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. Now that's pretty plain, isn't it? We're not fancifully interpreting that passage. The Lord was good enough to tell us exactly who he was going to talk about. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia. Now, remember, this is a couple hundred years before Alexander the Great was even on the scene. And at this time, Greece was almost unheard of. A little province over there in the European continent, but nothing really to speak of, but yet the great horn between his eyes is the first king, but that being broken, there are four who stood up for it. The four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. None of the generals had the same power and all that Alexander the Great had. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to a full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Now, difficulties here. Number one, in the earlier portion of the prophecy, he was prophesying concerning Antiochus Epiphanes and his profanation of the temple, but that was actually he was a type of the Antichrist. And you can look at him for a interesting type of the Antichrist. But as we get to verse 23, he speaks now of the one of which he was the type. According to some interpretations. Now, those who interpret that we are getting to the Antichrist, the true Antichrist, are those who tell you that the Antichrist has to come out of Syria. And this is where you've probably read some of the commentators who said that the Antichrist is going to come out of Syria. And this is why. Because of Antiochus Epiphanes being the general that was over Syria, and in the latter days, the man of which he was the type would come out of Syria. Now, there are other Bible expositors such as Gabalene, and that is in Talbot takes the position that the Antichrist is going to be an Assyrian, come out of Syria. But Gabalene, another respected evangelical expositor, believes that there will be, that this man, again, is not the actual Antichrist, but a man who will precede him and come down into Jerusalem and conquer the holy city. One interesting thing about prophecy is you never fully understand it until it's been fulfilled. And thus, any kind of dogmatism is usually not in order. It's best to just leave it open and say, well, it's interesting. There seems to be problems here in putting the whole thing together. Because as we get into the next chapter, the Antichrist definitely comes out of this revived Roman Empire. He's one of the horns, the 11th horn that destroys three. And so in chapter 7 and 9, he appears to be one thing. Here in 8, there are difficulties with this being the Antichrist. But surely he is close to him and could be him. We don't know for sure. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgression has come to the full. And boy, I'll tell you what, I as I look at the world, I think that we are in, really, the time when the transgressions are becoming full. I marvel at the patience of God and the long-suffering of God. Look at the world today. I see the blasphemies of the world today. I see what's happening here in the United States. I see the militancy of the homosexual community. And as I wondered, God, how long can you forbear? How long until you move in and do something? I'm sort of like Daniel, Lord, how long until the end of these things? I'll tell you, he's far more patient than I am. I would have banged heads quite a while ago and gotten rid of a lot of these. But God is patient. So, and I'm sort of glad, too, that he is patient. He's been patient with me, and I appreciate that. But I don't appreciate his patience with others. So when the transgressions have come to the full, the Bible speaks of the cup of his, the indignation of his wrath begins to overflow. It's being reserved, the long-suffering of God. But we must remember that as God said in the days of Noah, that my spirit will not always strive with man. They came to the point where they went over the limit. And as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be at the day, at the time of the coming of the Son of Man. And what were marks of the days of Noah? Well, one of them was increased worship of Satan, demonism, the sons of God, the daughters of men, and this cohabiting that began to take place. In the days of Noah, every man, God saw that the thoughts and the imagination of the minds of man was nothing but evil continually. And we are coming to that place again where the thoughts and the imagination of man's hearts, evil continually. And every man was doing that which was right in his own sight. It was a time when relativism had become the popular philosophy. It's do what you feel. Truth is what you believe. And every man becomes his own judge, and everyone does that which is right in his own eyes. And so the relativistic philosophy that was vogue in that day. And so we look around today and we see those things again happening, the transgression coming to the full. A king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not his own power. Now, this is what causes us to believe that the man is the Antichrist. Because in Revelation chapter 13, concerning the Antichrist, we read that Satan gave to him his throne, his authority, and his power. So this man of sin, endued with the power of Satan, and so he rises up, mighty, but not in his own power. He will destroy awesomely, and shall prosper in practice, and shall destroy the mighty and holy people. We know that the Antichrist is going to come to make war against the Jews. And through his policy also, he will cause craft to prosper in his hand. It will be a time of economic prosperity. The fellow will have some fascinating kind of solutions to some of our economic problems. He will magnify himself in his heart. The Bible says he will exalt himself above God and all that is called God. And by peace shall he destroy many. So he'll be riding in on a peace program. And we see how powerful the peace movement has become today. And all they need is just a strong leader. He also will stand up against the prince of princes as he seeks to thwart the establishing of the kingdom of Jesus Christ. But he will be broken without a hand. For we read concerning the Antichrist that he'll be destroyed by the brightness of the coming of Christ, and by the word that goes forth out of his mouth. And so without a hand, the Lord won't, you know, the Antichrist is going to be so powerful that the world is going to say, who can make war against him? Well, when the Lord comes, he just says, drop dead, man. I mean, it just, the word that goes forth out of his mouth, the sharp two-edged sword, the Antichrist is defeated, broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Therefore, shut up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And so Daniel tells of his own physical reaction. I fainted. I was sick for a period of days, and afterwards I rose up and I did the king's business. And I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. So he sealed up the vision. Now, in the 12th chapter of the book of Daniel, again, he was commanded to seal up the vision. Verse 4, but thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. And many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. What is the Lord saying? That at the time of the end, the knowledge will be increased. In other words, the book of Daniel was to be sealed until the times of the end. And as we now have the advantage of history, where Daniel was writing these things when Grisha was hardly even heard of, writing of this great king that would be broken in his strength, and four kings rising in his place, and of this one king that would magnify himself against God and desecrate the temple. That was all, I mean, what in the world? He didn't understand these goats and these rams and all of this kind of stuff. And even a lot of these things were not understood for many years, and so seal it up. But now, living in our days, as we are coming to the culmination of the age, as the transgression is coming to a full, we are living in the days when the book is no longer sealed, but the Lord is giving understanding. Knowledge shall be increased. Now, we use that so often as a prophecy of technology and the knowledge of science being increased. And we talk about the information age and how that through computers we've been able to double our knowledge from the years 1960 to 1970. The accumulated knowledge of the world was doubled. In other words, everything that man had learned from Adam up till 1970, or in that next decade, the accumulated knowledge of man doubled. And it is increasing so rapidly, even yet, we're on an exponential kind of a increase of knowledge. And so people say, well, knowledge shall be increased. Well, the Lord was talking about a particular knowledge, the knowledge and the understanding of the prophecies that would be increased. And that's why it's so foolish for people to set aside prophecy and say, well, I don't really understand it, and so I don't speak much on it and all. Well, what do you, the Bible, for the most part, is prophecy, so what in the world do you speak on if you don't speak on prophecy, you know? And so I think that we are encouraged to understand the book of Daniel. Jesus, in talking to his disciples and answering in response to their questions of the last days and the signs of the last days, he refers back to the book of Daniel and he said, let him that readeth understand. Jesus is saying, understand it now. And so there is that encouragement to understand. If you find yourself really problem with prophecy, I would suggest the book by Dwight Pentecost, Things to Come. It's probably the encyclopedia of prophecy, and it is an excellent book, and I think that it should be in your library. Things to Come by Dwight Pentecost, which really gives to you probably one of the most scholarly overviews of prophecy that you'll find. But something that we should all of us be very interested in and concerned about, because we're living in the times of the fulfillment of these prophecies.
This is the end of side two and the end of this message. For further information on tapes or a free catalog, contact Chapel Tapes at P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628.